There are today 36 million boys and girls in our American public school system. How they are taught and what they are taught are manifestly objects of universal and paramount interest. The school system, like so many of the other institutions of our society, is a social organism in transition. There is a transition from the small individual school units to the large agglomeration of consolidated schools. A chain brought about because of financial necessity, because of the necessity of specialization, because schools are recognizing more and more that they must present a multi-level program. One level designed to enrich the studies of the academically gifted, one designed to ground faithfully the academically average, and one designed to give basic training and vocational guidance to the dexterous but academically awkward. There is a change going on in the curriculum of our public schools. The space age and our shrunken globe have made it manifest to all that we must give to the young people a greater dose of foreign language, science training, of mathematics. We are introducing these studies to a greater degree and at an earlier age into the curriculum. There has been a revolution in teaching techniques. Television in the classroom, the language laboratory, all manner of audiovisual aids have brought motion and dimension to what was previously a classroom situation which was static and largely dependent upon the spoken word. And finally, there has been a clarification of the function of the public school. The Supreme Court decision of 1954 insisted the public school must not only be a classroom for teaching, but a classroom of democracy. The schools must follow an open door policy, and that the high barriers of segregation established in the South, and the conventional gerrymandered barriers of segregation established in the North must disappear. That the American public school must become again a place where people of all races, economic classes, creeds, and the like can rub shoulders and forget and forgive the prejudices of their parents and of their ancestral groups. The growing sophistication of our society is then reflected in the growing sophistication of our public schools. And this is as it should be. For none of us would wish our young people to be taught just what we know. Our world is already the world of the proximate past. They must be equipped with the skills and the disciplines necessary to meet the challenges of the world of tomorrow. Now, as our society is meeting these challenges and is debating the function of the public school, obviously all areas of public school activity come into the discussion. Inevitably, the area of religion, the relation of the church and the classroom comes into debate, and with equal inevitability, this debate tends to break down into one of two discussions. The first, financial. The second, curricular. The financial discussion has to do with the division of tax funds raised for school purposes. In America, education is mandatory. Each of our several states has a law which requires attendance up to a given age in the public school system. However, each of our several states permits the parent to send his child to some private school licensed by the state which meets the educational requirements intended. There are today in America many private schools, military schools, preparatory schools, and parochial schools. The largest single block of these is obviously the Roman Catholic parochial school system. There are today in the Catholic school system 5,100,000 boys and girls. One out of every two Roman Catholic youth of of public school age. The school is extensive, expensive. It has been built up with remarkable rapidity. It has been built up because the Roman Catholic community does not feel that the moral and character education of the public schools is of a quality or of a philosophy which meets with their approval. Recently, the Jesuit associate editor of the magazine America, Father Neil McCluskey, set forth the Roman Catholic position in clear, unmistakable terms. A Catholic educator, he writes, starts with an assumption that God and religion are the central concern of human existence. Religion for a Catholic answers the question, what is man? What is man's chief end? Whence did he come? Whither is he going? How did he get here? Quite patently, the character of education will depend to a large extent on the answer to these questions. A Catholic believes that his first purpose in life is to learn to live in such a way as to prepare himself for an immortal, supernatural destiny. This precise purpose, not some vague humanitarianism, no matter how eloquently noble, will accordingly be the foundation of moral education and character training in the school, and will equip the Catholic child with a sense of values which will lend dignity and direction to whatever else he may learn. A Catholic parent can hardly be censured if he remains dissatisfied with a school in which character education and its sanctions must be limited to the secular order. This means that the ethical side of education may not be related to religious values, but must remain circumscribed by the purely secular. By default, civic or political virtue must be the primary goal of such a school. In other words, it exists primarily to produce the good citizen. Those who believe the perfection of the temporal social order to be the supreme and ultimate aim of life will have no quarrel with this interpretation of the public school's responsibility for character education. Those who, while believing in a supernatural dimension to education and life, see here no irrevocable conflict of value systems, can continue to give full allegiance to the public school value program. Those believers in a supernatural who do see an irresolvable conflict cannot. The conclusion is inescapable. For millions of American families, the public school system as it presently exists is simply incapable of caring for the moral side of education. Now, we need not agree with either the pedagogic or the theologic propositions implicit in this statement. I certainly do not. But we cannot disagree with the right of the Catholic community to establish its own schools. The public school must, in a democracy, not be a coercive instrument of statism. The right of dissent is precious. We have always allowed in our nation individuals who dissent from a particular national program of policy to establish as best they can instruments to express their own particular point of view. This is a good legal principle which has been established in the Pierce case and elsewhere. It is constitutional and it is fundamental to our democracy. What then is at issue? Simply this. Catholic community has for a long time now and with yearly increasing vehemence been arguing that it deserves a share, a proportional share, of the funds raised for public education. It claims, and rightly, that it is educating a significant proportion of our American boys and girls, that it is educating them for American citizenship. It claims that its parents are paying taxes, as must all other citizens, and that they are therefore undergoing a double imposition, what they call double taxation. In the first place, they must pay their state, federal, and local taxes. Secondly, they must pay the tuition capital costs of maintaining this system of parochial education. This double cost obviously puts a difficult financial burden on many parents of moderate income. This is their claim. It can be answered, of course, on many levels. The very term double taxation is misleading. It may appear so to the Catholic parent, but the only taxation which is compulsory is that imposed by local or state governments. Tuition, contribution to building programs of parish schools are voluntary. They are undertaken because those individuals believe that they cannot avail themselves of the services of the national institution. Yet the public school doors are open. Public schools are prepared to educate each and every young gentleman or gentle lady. And the public schools have seen to it by and large that all religious practices and religious teachings which might be offensive to any denomination are excluded from the daily routine and curriculum. The undertaking then of parochial education is a luxury, part of the luxury of dissent. And it does not follow necessarily that the cost of maintaining this second school system must be in part met from public funds. Indeed, constitutionally, it cannot be met from public funds. The First Amendment to our Constitution precludes the National Congress from passing a law which deals with the establishment of any religion. A parochial school has two functions, one educative, and one a function of indoctrination. And these two functions cannot be separated out. Obviously, any massive aid to the parochial school system would be aid in the dissemination, the teaching, the indoctrination of a particular faith, and contrary to the spirit of separation, which was a spirit in which our founding fathers established the democratic nation we enjoy. There is a second point at issue here, and it is this. The public school is an agency of national policy. It has been democratically determined to be necessary to the unfolding of the democratic system. The public school system teaches open-mindedness. It permits class fluidity. It permits a mixing and mingling of people of a variety of backgrounds and gives us the opportunity for communication, for shared experience, for tearing down the ancient walls of separation which were brought over from Europe or from Africa or elsewhere, and which, if allowed to rise high, would segregate and separate our society into little millet groups, religiously centered, ethnically centered, racially centered, each existing in the American polity, but each a separate atom of that polity, and none feeling a sense of integrity with, of partnership in, of fellowship with all other groups. No one can dissent from a national policy by refusing to pay the upkeep of that agency. A conscientious objector may not refuse to pay taxes even though he knows that a significant proportion of his tax money goes to the military. The Catholic parent, the private school parent, all those who would enjoy the privilege of providing a private education for their children, one different than that which the community determines upon, must pay the freight of that education, and as an added cost, must be willing to pay the freight of the education which is available to their child, but which they have voluntarily rejected for their child. Now, what brings this issue into focus at this moment? Simply this. For a long time now, the need for federal monies for local educational needs has been manifest. Both parties had, as a part of their national planks in the last campaign, provisions for bills of federal aid to education. The bills differed in wording, but not in purpose. The need for such monies is apparent to all. Now, in the past, parochial school interests, largely Catholic, have met with segregationist interests of the South who are determined that no federal money shall be given to public schools which have anti-segregation strings attached to them, and have defeated any and every attempt to pass a bill sending federal monies into our public schools. You may recall some 10 years ago when Cardinal Spellman led quite vehemently and openly the attack on the Barden Bill, the last major federal aid bill which had an opportunity of passage. Now, such a bill will be presented in the next Congress, of that which we can be certain. If the Catholic community practices a religious self-restraint, if it allows, because of the urgency of the public need, this federal aid bill to education to pass, even though it makes no provision, as it cannot make any provision, for federal monies to parochial schools, it will be permitting the passage of a bill of prime national interest, great urgency, and it will be performing a great service. It is to be hoped that this will be the position of the church. First, the church is obdurate, and if it continues to oppose politically with every political tool at its disposal the passage of such bills, it will not only prevent a necessary shot in the arm to our public school systems, it will meet defeat ultimately in its selfish purpose, the purpose of gaining federal monies for the parochial school system, and it will split our community apart in a great national debate over the First Amendment of the Constitution, over its implications, and over the responsibility and the needs of the public school system. Indeed, if the bill were to pass enabling federal monies to go to the parochial schools, and if by some impossibility the courts were to rule such a bill constitutional, there is danger implicit here that the whole public school system as we know it might disappear. Throughout the Southland, there are many, many small groups ready to seize upon local empty weekday church schools and federal monies to build up again white supremacy schools to undermine and destroy the intent of the Supreme Court decision. In great portions of our land, the public school system as we know it would disappear to be replaced by a system of denominational schools, religious schools, segregationist schools, and one wonders what is the ultimate result for the health and the well-being and the vitality of our American community. And if the Catholic Church can, in this instance, practice a commendable self-restraint, there are ways in which aid can be tendered to it, ways which would not do violation to the spirit or the letter of our Constitution. Democracy thrives on accommodation, on cooperation, on compromise. There was no great opposition to the government monies flowing into denominational schools through GI scholarships. There has been little opposition to the granting of science textbook aid, science equipment developed by federal agencies to promote the new physics and new chemistry necessary for the modern age to private and public schools alike. There has been little local opposition to the extension of medical care and even of free lunches into the parochial school system. There are ways in which cooperatively, through compromise, some financial aid can be given to the parochial schools in those areas which are purely of benefit to the individual child, in those areas in which they are obviously undertaking a responsibility of the citizenry and of the public. It is to be hoped that this will be the result. If it is not, the year or two ahead will see a heightening of interreligious tensions, one which will do good neither for the well-being and the integrity of our community, nor for the posture of our nation vis-a-vis the world at large. I spoke of two issues, two areas of interest, of conflict. The first, financial, the second, curricular. There has been a definite mounting interest in bringing religion into the classrooms of America. This interest has been largely developed by thoughtful Protestant groups, the National Council of Churches, the American Council of Churches. It was reflected in the White House Conference on Children and Youth, in debates before the NEA and the PTA and nationally. The spirit of this debate is largely signaled by Justice Douglas in a famous 1952 decision on release time, in which he said that the institutions of our society presuppose a supreme being. One may question his historical acumen and accuracy, but one cannot question the fact that Justice Douglas here reflected the mood of America at mid-century, the mood which saw to it that we amended the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag to include the phrase, "One nation under God," the mood which saw to it that we overprinted our money with the motto, "In God we trust." The mood which is reflected in the rather thoughtless way in which occasional Protestant ministers in public invocations and benedictions will refer to our Christian democracy. Religion in mid-century has become a matter of loyalty. The Cold War, face-to-face with an atheistic enemy, has made religion both a test of and a tool of good citizenship. Now, this interest to bring religion into the public school systems is seen in many different ways. 13 of our states make mandatory a daily Bible reading at the beginning of each school day. And perhaps one out of every four of our school communities, the day is begun with prayer, usually with the Lord's Prayer from the book of Matthew in the New Testament. There has been considerable effort to develop what is called a Common Core curriculum. By this, the educators mean a distillation of the best and noblest ethic of all religions, spiritual, theistic, agreed upon by all. Unfortunately, this has become largely, it has developed largely into a pabulum kind of ethic. One which can give no indigestion and have developed no allergic reaction from any group, and yet at the same time cannot ennoble or vitalize or invigorate any child or any group. Perhaps one in three of our communities have developed a release time program, which permits the school to curtail its teaching hours to release the children for attendance at Sunday school, church school, synagogue school, and the like, holding in the school dissident children, children of disbelieving parents, keeping them busy at study hall or some other type of inane and unnecessary activity. Some schools, especially in rural communities, teach religion as part of the everyday classroom program. Either a representative of the ministerial association enters the classroom to teach, or the teacher herself undertakes this process. And we Jewish parents are, of course, cognizant of the annual December migraine, which forces upon our children a decision between participation in some Christmas celebration and a feeling of being left out. This migraine, this annual migraine, has become more severe of late because under ministerial prodding, the schools are busy putting Christ back into Christmas, and hitherto innocuous chorales and plays have become nativity plays overlaid with significant Christological and theological impetus and interest. There is, in other words, a great concern by many thoughtful people in America, by many groups in America, that the religious teaching must somehow be introduced into, become part of, the daily routine of the classroom. Now, it is hard to pinpoint the reasons, the causes for this renewed interest. I suspect that in part it derives from the cancer of juvenile delinquency and the belief by many that a good deal more religious training would somehow curb the spread of this evidence of the breakdown in the character and the emotional development of our young people. I suspect also that it is in part a testament to the failure of the Sunday school system as it is practiced in many Protestant communities. The youngsters are not conspicuous by attendance, Most, or at least a significant number, do not attend, and the schools hope in this way, the churches hope in this way, to reach and to teach and to indoctrinate. I suspect equally that part of this impetus derives from the fear psychology, which has been definitely a dimension of American life in the last decade. But whatever be the reasons, the fact remains that we are confronted by thoughtful, large, powerful bodies who are determined to introduce some form of religious indoctrination into the school system. Now, as a religionist, as one who believes deeply with every fiber in his body of the importance of a spiritual commitment, of the integrity of one's faith, I cannot, however, but feel that these attempts to introduce religion into the public schools are educationally naive, politically unsound, constitutionally questionable, and religiously self-defeating. Take Bible reading as an example. How will Bible reading affect the character of our young people? Will it teach them ethics? Haven't we long since become sophisticated enough to know that the reading of noble sentiments does not ennoble necessarily one's character? You learn by living, by experience, by taking for yourself fine examples, by fighting through in your own self temptation, compromise, challenge. You do not learn by reading the maxims of ancient teachers. Sometimes these can verbalize for you thoughts, sentiments which you have felt and not been able to put into terms. But your own commitments precede this verbalization. The verbalization is to have any meaning. And think of the problems which such an issue as Bible reading entails. What Bible shall be read? The Old Testament? How can a Christian who believes in the New Dispensation be satisfied only with the Old Testament? The New Testament? What of the integrity of Jewish faith, which denies the Christological teachings of the New Testament? And what version of the Bible shall be read? The King James, the Douay, the Revised Standard Version, the Jewish Publication Society? Some take prophecy as poetry, other prophecy as fact. Some interpret a Hebrew phrase to indicate the coming of the Christ Messiah. The other, our own, fails to see any indication in this phrase of this teaching. Who shall interpret this teaching? Shall it be read as literature? Will that satisfy those who believe the Bible is fundamental truth? Shall it be read fundamentalistically, literally? Will this satisfy us who see in the Bible moral teachings primarily and great moral poetry? No, I am afraid that the reading of the Bible, the performing of the sancta of religion within a public school setting can neither ennoble nor teach the children the depth, the beauty, the holiness, which is the essence of religion. I question the politics of all of this. We in America have been fortunate. We have had cooperative and cooperating religious communities, communities which have come together for common purpose, which have exchanged often pulpits, points of view, congregations, which have been willing to participate equally as pluralistic entities in our democratic society. I can see only where the questions of the introduction of religion into the public schools will pull these religious denominations apart. It cannot but be otherwise. Each of us is committed to the integrity, the sanctity, and the truth of his own point of view. And especially where religion is dogmatic and doctrinal and salvationistic, do the ministers and priests of such faith find it impossible, not only difficult, but impossible, to compromise on some commonly accepted position. And more than this, have we the right to read out of the American fold those young people whose parents are unwilling to make a religious commitment? Or have made a commitment for irreligion, disbelief, or wish their children to be raised without being indoctrinated in any faith that later they may make some commitment of their own? Is this kind of coercive religion the American way? I seriously question it. And I question whether religion in the long run will be the gainer. And I would put before you this simple fact. Go across the length and breadth of our globe and search for the religious revival, and you will find it in only one nation of the world, our own. Throughout Europe, throughout South America, throughout Asia, religious interest is on the decline. These are societies which are largely secular and interested in secular things. Only in America, where religion has been non-coercive, where religion has not allied itself with the power of the state, where no young person has felt himself obligated to mumble the sanctities of some faith in which he did not believe. Only here has religion showed itself in its purity, and because it was pure, only here has been able to command the respect of thinking individuals. If religion is to thrive in America, it must thrive in freedom. It must thrive in the way it has flourished till now. This is the American way, and for religion it has been a successful way. And I question the political sagacity of those religionists who seek to coerce the captive audience of 35, 36 million school children, and who believe that by indoctrinating them at an age before they have critical minds of their own, they are adding to the strength, adding to the substance, or making sure the future of their own faith. Now, I do not presume an absolute zone of silence between the classroom and the church. Religion is an integral part of our civilization. You cannot teach history without teaching religion. Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, these are important historical figures as well as religious figures. You cannot teach literature in the upper grades without teaching of religion. How can you understand English literature without understanding the Bible? These ought to be taught as part and parcel of the normal curriculum of the school. They are sensitive areas, delicate areas, but they can be taught. And I find no argument with ministers and priests and rabbis who enter the school upon invitation on national holidays to verbalize the meaning of these holidays to the young people. I find nothing that I can rant against or be opposed to in the taking of schools, classrooms, to visit individual churches in a community to see how the community worships and to learn of its ways. But I do violently oppose with every fiber in my body, the imposition of religious practices upon the minds of the very young, minds which are not yet discriminating, which have yet no critical apparatus which allows them to separate fact from fancy, dogma from truth. Of this danger, our schools, in my estimation, must beware, and despite community pressure, they must avoid. Ultimately, our public schools rest upon the interest and the involvement of each and every one of us. The philosophy of a public school curriculum is determined locally. If we are determined to maintain the benevolent neutrality between church and classroom, then each of us has the obligation to interest himself in his local school, to participate in its discussions, to make known his views, to communicate those views to his neighbors, to put this whole issue in perspective for those with whom he lives. The battle to preserve the benevolent neutrality at present existing in our schools will be a long one and a difficult one, and one which often will engender much heat and much debate. But it is a battle which can be won. It is a struggle which must be won. Ultimately, the American society which we know and we prize rests squarely on the success of our public school system. Ultimately, its integrity, the spirit of democracy which it engenders into the young, ultimately, its unwillingness to segregate along adult lines any child, its determination to create within the classroom a homogeneous democratic situation. Ultimately, that philosophy makes the wheels of our democracy to turn and the machinery of our democracy to work. Our public schools are in many areas embattled schools. In this area, at least, we should lend them our complete support.